Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verses 12 through 19. In the year 1544, Martin Bucer, who was a partner with Calvin, if you will, compatriot, fighting the good fight of Reformation, especially in that part of Europe, suggested that he prepare a tract, which he did. Tract meant something a little different than it does today. It stretched to about 155 pages, but a tract entitled The Necessity of Reforming the Church. You've heard me allude to this tract on previous occasions. It was presented at the Diet of Speyer in 1544. And Calvin said these words, or wrote these words, about the necessity of reforming the church. He believed that the church had fallen under insufferable tyranny under the hand of Rome, and so again, the importance of reforming the church. He says, if it be required then, by what things chiefly the Christian religion has a standing existence amongst us and maintains its truth, it will be found that the following two not only occupy the principal place, but comprehend under them all the other parts, and consequently the whole substance of Christianity. Two things, Calvin says, mark out the Christian religion, not only in terms of their principal place, but also for the substance, or the whole substance of Christianity. Two things. First, a knowledge first of the mode in which God is duly worshipped. And secondly, the source from which salvation is obtained. When these are kept out of view, though we may glory in the name of Christians, our profession is empty and vain. We might put this in more contemporary language and say that these two things are soteriology, that is, the doctrine of salvation, and ecclesiology, or the doctrine of the church, and more narrowly, liturgy, that is, the worship of God in the public worship of God. Now, when we think of those two things, soteriology and liturgy, we are inclined to think that one comes before the other, that is, soteriology is something we encounter, first of all, and for many of us, that may have been the case. That is, we came to understand the doctrines of grace, we embrace them, and then later on, we began to have a greater concern for the worship of God. But Calvin says that's backwards, that the reality is we ought to, and it's necessary for us to wrestle with liturgy first and then sociology subsequently. Why is that? Because Calvin believed that it is in the context of the public worship of the people of God that we encounter God, that we encounter Him primarily in that context, and that we encounter Him savingly in that context. Now, with all of the media that we have today, that's not always the case. But Calvin, I think, is right. Ideally, we need to come to terms with the worship of God. And as we come to terms with the worship of God, then we will come to understand better the God whom we worship and the salvation that has been bestowed upon us. In other words, Calvin is saying to us, and this text will reinforce that, that the public nature of worship cannot be ignored apart from the withering of one's soul. Matthew Henry puts it this way: we have here the second attempt, that is in this text, to bring the ark home to the city of David, and this succeeded, though the former miscarried. Again, we've noticed that it miscarried because of the foolishness of those who sought to carry the ark, violating the very terms of how the ark was to be carried from place to place. David grew angry, and then David grew frustrated and at the judgment of God. Calvin, in his volume of sermons on this text, says, "It may suddenly happen that while we are in, pain and do not see clearly enough, we may suffer frivolous worries which proceed from our own carelessness." And so now David sees that the ark is carried, and rightly so, reminding us that God intends to do good and to produce good and to bring good to his people. Verse 12, or verses 11 and 12, are kind of watershed verses in this passage. David, out of his frustration and anger and disappointment, leaves the ark, abandons the ark, and places it in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite, and it remained there for 3 months. And Jehovah blessed him. Blessed him because of the presence of the ark. Why is the ark so important? I've already alluded to that. The ark was at the very center of Israelite life. If you thought of anything that was at the center of their life, that the glue that held them together, it was the ark. The ark was also the center of Israel's worship. Worship revolved around the tabernacle and the ark within the tabernacle, and later the temple and the ark within the temple. And so God intended to do good, not evil. Intended to do good, and did so, proving that by doing good to the house of Obed-Edom. Not only to him, but to his entire household. And in verse 12, we discover that word makes its way to David, and David acts, now coming to terms with the goodness of God that centers around the ark of God. Now, what does all of this say to us? By way of a theme, as it were. And we can put it this way in contemporary language, if we want, or more contemporary language: no church, no blessing. No church, no blessing. Now, again, the language is Old Testament language, but the thought carries us along, or carries itself along. Because no worship, no blessing. Now, that's not to say that all blessing is gone, but that blessing that comes solely in the context of public worship cannot be gleaned or gained in any other way. No church, no blessing, because no worship, no blessing. I want for us to notice then several aspects having to do with the public worship of the people of God from this particular text. There are a number of things that we can see and can be gleaned from the text. The first thing that we discover in verse 12 is the importance of attendance upon public worship. Or to put it differently, the problem of distance. Here is the first principle of worship. Attendance to the public means of grace. Again, the language is Old Testament language, but notice the centrality of the ark and the blessing that the ark brought to this individual's household, and that comes to David's attention. The first principle of worship, then, is attendance to the public means of grace. David did not. He left it in this man's house. He was marked by avoidance and non-attendance, placing, again, the ark in a private home. We again recall David's anger, his annoyance, his anxiety for the future. Would the ark ever come to him? And David is paralyzed and does nothing. When confronted by God's holiness, David reacts. When confronted by God's holiness, sinners are often tempted to turn away in avoidance and adopt an alternative agenda. How often we attempt to domesticate the holy God. Dale Ralph Davis writes, "And yet the Lord's people tend to forget what sort of God they face. We forget that there is heat in his holiness. No, we need not be terrified, but being a little scared wouldn't hurt either." And so news of blessing comes David's way. News of blessing leaks out, as it were, to David. And he draws the conclusion, as we've already indicated, that God intends to bless, not to curse. Obed-Edom's blessing likely took the form of material blessing. And God does bless his people. He does bless us materially, and we find that our needs are met. But as we give thought to this passage, and as we give thought to the teaching of the New Testament, and as we give thought to the benefits of the New Covenant, we understand and can appreciate that the blessings that come to us and come to us through the New Covenant and come to us through the presence of God and the presence of God in the Lord Jesus Christ are spiritual marks more than they are material. God blesses his people with advancing in spiritual matters, acceptance with God, reconciliation, joy, integrity, a changed heart, ability to do the will of God, humility, as pride is abased, the sons of God in adoption, as well as the status of righteousness. These are blessings that come to us, and these are blessings that we hear about. These are blessings that even come to us in a greater or an increased fashion in the context of public worship. Joseph Hall, the Anglican Puritan, said, "The God of heaven pays liberally for his lodging." It's a great statement, isn't it? The God of heaven pays liberally for his lodging. There is no substitute. There is no substitute for attendance to the public means of grace. Here is a healthy reminder to us of the importance of what we're doing even now after having spent months necessarily depending upon live stream alone. And that's been a great help to us, but it doesn't replace the coming together of the people of God. Rick Phillips writes, as the Israelites were to reverence God in the presence of the ark, believers today should account him holy as they attend the ordinances that Christ has commanded for his church. And you may recall last week, one of the quotations from him as well was, the neglect or pollution of worship is always a sign of spiritual decline. So the ark is lodged in the house of a private person. David learns that blessing has come to this man's household, and David wants that blessing. Now comes to his senses, realizes that he has been wrong, and seeks to correct the matter and bring the ark to Jerusalem. And so the matter and the importance of attendance upon the public means of grace is followed by preference or deference, preference for God's will with regard to public worship. This time, David corrects his previous mistake. And he has the ark carried, and 1 Chronicles chapter 15 is a parallel passage, a parallel text, which tells us or fills in some of the blanks that we don't have here in this particular context. But David corrects the matter, sees that the ark is carried to Jerusalem in the appropriate manner, the very manner that God had dictated. Furthermore, David's effort was marked by elation, with joy. This is no dead formal activity. We sang this morning Psalm 100, and the spirit of that psalm is also echoed in Psalm 2 and verse 11, where both passages speak of rejoicing with trembling. David's heart was in what he was doing. David's effort was marked by sacrifices of thanksgiving, by appreciation. David's effort was marked by admiration and respect and reverence for what he was doing. Notice they took six steps and then they offered this sacrifice. There's nothing haphazard here, nothing slapdash about what David is doing. And his effort was marked by discretion. By that I mean that David, in this context, has a true understanding of who he is, coupled with an understanding of who God is. Notice that he strips off his royal robes. Now, this is given different commentaries, all sorts of worries that I think are unnecessary. The linen ephod was something that a priest would wear underneath his priestly robes, but it was also a very common undergarment. Some have suggested, well, David is actually making the sacrifices, but that can't be. David wasn't a priest. He certainly promoted the offering of sacrifices, but he could not have been offering them himself. What is in view here then? What is in view here is that David, in stripping off his royal robes, and everyone who would have recognized who he was and what he was and his importance, and he could have entered into Jerusalem with all of the pomp and circumstance afforded a great king, but he doesn't do that. He humbles himself before the ark of God. He humbles himself by wearing what we might say is a common t-shirt, very long one, obviously, but something that would have been very common. Here is David at his best, because it is David at his lowest before God. David is at his best because he humbles himself before his God. This is not David stripped and parading himself in naked fashion, as some liberals have suggested, but the very opposite. In fact, Calvin puts it this way. Now, the type of dress described here means that a man undressed himself and put on nothing but a linen cloth for cover, inasmuch as decency required it. In other words, this is not indecent. Well, here David took off his royal garments and all the pompous accessories to which he was so accustomed, and was covered with nothing but a linen cloth. So here he was there like a poor man, one of the simplest and commonest populace. David had a true sense of who he was before the God who he had now come to understand who he was. There is nothing casual, nothing careless about the movement of the ark. Thirdly, not only attendance and deference or reverence, but also obedience, compliance. In verses 16 through 18, there's a marked difference between the moving of the ark in the previous section and the moving of the ark now, as David gives leadership to this event. The journey was about a 10-mile journey from the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, to Jerusalem. David had made arrangements for the ark to be placed in a tent or a tabernacle, not necessarily the original one. Text doesn't indicate whether it was or whether it was not. But again, 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and again chapter 16 give to us some added information. David leads the entourage into the city, remembering, of course, that there was a national component to ancient Israel which doesn't exist today. In other words, no nation is a spiritual nation, as it were, as Israel was. But David gives leadership as the king, leads the entourage into the city, wearing this linen ephod, and the ark was placed in the tent that had been prepared for it. And again, David sees that sacrifices are offered. Doesn't mean that he offered them. Again, that would have been an impossibility. That was not his role at all. But the reference in chapter 6 here in verse 13 suggests sacrifices that were suitable for atonement. In other words, David recognizes and he encourages the people to recognize that they're sinners in need of forgiveness. And where is that atonement to be found but in the ark or on the ark with the shedding of blood? And then David gives gifts, even as God gives gifts to us, a kind of benediction from David's hand. We need to see again that what David is doing here is marked by obedience, now finally, to the Word of God. Everything from sacrifice to moving the ark legitimately to placing it temporarily in a tent, for it was Solomon who would eventually build the temple. All of these things conforming, the ark being covered, which we read of in 1 Chronicles, all of these things reflecting David's obedience, giving leadership to obedience to, again, picking up language from our confessions, our Protestant confessions, the regulative principle of worship. Now, what was done in ancient Israel is not the template for us today, dancing before the Lord and so forth. And we don't have an ark, except in a metaphorical sense. But we are given instructions in the scriptures, in the New Covenant scriptures, as to how worship is to be regulated. We don't have time to turn to these texts this morning. We've certainly preached on them in a number on a number of different occasions. The components of worship, or the elements of worship, are revealed to us in passages like Acts chapter 2, verses 41 and following. Baptism, preaching of the Word of God, the offerings that we bring before the Lord, communion or the Lord's Supper, so there are two sacraments, common prayers, and then picking up from Ephesians and Colossians, the place in the importance of, in public, singing the praises of our God. And so there are the elements of worship, even benediction, as we discover from the New Testament or New Covenant scriptures, as the minister pronounces blessing at the end of a service. Those are the elements. Those things are non-negotiable. Confession also speaks of circumstances. Circumstances are not mandated. Circumstances are just things, that things like lights, what kind of lights, pews or chairs. There's no distinction to be made. Times of services. Our morning service is at 10 o'clock. When I was a boy growing up, I think every church I knew had service at 11 o'clock. I'm not sure what the significance of that was, if there was any. It was just you went to church at 11 o'clock. You went to Sunday school at 9:30. Service was at 11 o'clock. And of course, in my Lutheran context, there was no evening service, but churches that had them, that was usually at 7 or 7:30 in the evening. Farming communities have their services at different times. In Cuba, services are very early in the morning because it's too hot later in the day. Those are circumstances. There are all sorts of things that make up circumstances. We can place our chairs close together. We can put them farther apart. Those are circumstances. They're not mandated. Those are not things that are mandated. What kind of light? What kind of heat? Do we have a boiler in the basement? Do we have electric heat? What kind of those are all circumstances. They're not elements of worship. And now during these days of pandemic, there are those who seemingly want to make circumstances into elements and suggest that the regular principle of worship is being violated. I would take issue with that. It's an important distinction. Elements are elements, circumstances are circumstances. Calvin writes, "Be that as it may, let us note that when we start following our desires to worship God in our own way, our fantasies always become sacrilegious. If we fall away from His word, irreverence will increase to the point of sacrilege." Now, the fourth item that we discover has already been alluded to, at least to some degree, and that is this whole matter of joy or exuberance in verses 14 and 15. David again sings and dances with great joy. One of the elements of worship, or one of the important parts of worship, not an element, but an important attitude in worship, is this matter of joy or exuberance. Contrary to all formalism. Now, we need form, and there's an order to worship, but worship ought to bring great delight to the soul as we come to understand and appreciate who it is that we worship, what it is that we are doing, whose presence is principal among us. And we often pray to that end. In the invocation, as we begin our service, or even in the pastoral prayer, contrary to formalism, form for its own sake, or ritualism, ritual for its own sake, Davis writes, "Here is holy delirium over the presence of God." Holy delirium. Now, there's another element of, not an element of worship, but a principle that is to be found here. And that's vigilance. That when the people of God and the true people of God seek to worship God truly according to God's regulative principles, they often face opposition. Opposition can take a number of forms: not understanding the regular principle, confusing elements and circumstances. There are all sorts of ways in which opposition can be realized. But in the particular context, it's the opposition that comes as the result of David's wife, Michal, who was Saul's daughter. She demonstrates disdain and disgust over David's wearing only a linen ephod, singing and dancing somewhat deliriously before the Lord. And it would suggest several things about her. That her attitude or her approach was in view of her own self-importance. She's the wife of David. She's the wife of the king. Everything ought to be done with a certain level of decorum. Everything ought to be done with a certain level of taste. And David is violating all of that. She's embarrassed. She demonstrates disdain. This is no way for the king to behave. And besides, it puts me in a bad light as well. The matter is one of her insistence upon her own dignity. But I think there's something else here. If you read the text very carefully, all the way through to the end of the chapter, she is referred to as the daughter of Saul, not as the wife of David. She is the wife of David. We know that. But she's referred to as the daughter of Saul. Three times she's referred to as the daughter of Saul. Michal has made absolutely no change whatsoever in her attitude or her perspective now that she has been returned to her husband. She's not teachable. She's unwilling to adapt. Certainly doesn't see the significance and the importance of what is taking place here. She remains at this very moment a part of the old guard. She's the daughter of Saul. She's not thinking like David, but like Saul. Again, she's a part of the old guard, a part of the old order. Here's the voice of the old age, that is the previous age. Here's the voice of the previous regime, not the voice of that which has now become new in David. Arthur Pink writes, "Let not those who are engaged in the happy service of the Lord be surprised when they encounter antagonism, when so far from their efforts appreciated by all, there will be some who decry and denounce them." And so vigilance is required on the part of the people of God to maintain their integrity in the worship of God, to maintain their integrity in identifying accurately and truly the elements of worship and being able to distinguish between elements and circumstances, and then doing what comes ought to come naturally to the people of God, whether they're many or few in number. And that is to gather with the people of God to worship Him. Well, there's one final thing that we discover in verses 18 and 19, and that is the matter of assurance. That there is in David's actions here the assurance that God is doing good and not evil. In 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 18, and again, we must not confuse or conflate David's role or an old covenant pressing of certain things upon the new covenant people of God. But notice here that David blesses the people of God in the name of Jehovah. Now, he's not a priest, so he can't do that in a priestly fashion, but he could have it done. He blessed the people in the name of the Lord. And he certifies that blessing by the giving of material goods to the people. Much like the benediction at the end of a service that's pronounced today by a minister of the gospel, this benediction gave confidence to the people of God, even as the reciting of biblical texts by way of benediction give you assurance, confidence to lay hold of blessing through faith in Jesus Christ. Here, David was giving the people assurance that God was present. William Blakey writes, "When David blessed the people, it was an assurance to them that God's blessing was within their reach. It was theirs if only they would take it." And that's confirmed by these physical or temporal gifts that David gives in the name of Jehovah. And the last verse, verse 18, says, "And they went home." Everyone went home, but not in the same way that they had come. They all went home, but not in the same way that they had come. They found themselves in the presence of God, who through David now had blessed them, and they went home full. When we think of worship, we also need to think of what we're doing. And we need to think of the necessary components of public worship. Consider the following. Consider the importance of the following. Consider the importance of what we do. That is, the elements. Consider the importance of how we do it. Serving the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. The importance of when we do it. And we haven't addressed that in this sermon because this text doesn't do it. But the importance of when we do it on the Lord's Day. Fourthly, the importance of why we do it. Who is it that we have in mind when we come to worship? What was it that David missed when he absented himself from being with the ark? It was the presence of God. Why do we do what we do? That is, who do we have in mind? Ought it not to be the triune God? The importance of what is to be avoided. Again, confusing elements and circumstances. The importance that we do it. And even the importance who leads us in doing it. But let me just leave you with some further thoughts very quickly. Holiness does not ban joy in worship. God's holiness is revealed in the first 11 verses. God's presence and the joy that that brings to the people of God in the remaining verses of this chapter. Holiness does not suppress joy, but stimulates it, David says. Rejoice with trembling. Davis also goes on to say, you have to be one of Zion's children to know how true this paradox is. Secondly, benediction or blessing comes through submission. paying attention to the regulative principle, employing the regulative principle, and being present at the worship, the public worship of the people of God. When we err, when we make a mistake, as David did, it's a mark of grace and humility to remedy those mistakes. As Blakey writes, the error that had proved so fatal was now rectified or corrected. And then thirdly, remember that God intends to help and not to harm. His great interest in public worship is to bless his people. God blesses his people, at least in part, in large part, through public worship. Avoid it, neglect it, and you will always be the poorer for it. Like Israel, when the ark comes to Jerusalem, you will go home, but not the same way that you came. Hence the command, directive, in Hebrews chapter 10, not to forsake the assembling of yourselves together as the manner of some. Apparently, even in New Testament days, there were people who had determined not to meet with the people of God. Joseph Hall again writes, "Never a man was a loser by true godliness." As the ark ascended to Jerusalem, bringing blessing to the people of God, so Jesus ascended into heaven and now bestows blessing upon his people through the means that he himself has appointed, first of all, through his own saving merits, and then to those who have trusted in him and rested upon him as they gather for public worship. He continues to pour out blessing upon them, upon you, and upon me. Let us pray.